I had a lot of reaction to Mr. Frank Rotering. I was disappointed in Mr. Rotering's discussion, and I'm sorry to say that. It's not like you guys gave a bad interview either. It was lively and entertaining. Rather, it seemed like most of Mr. Rotering's message, most of his entire theory of contractionism, was simply identifying the problems we face, the logic of capitalism, its effects, and the places it goes wrong. That identification, in and of itself, is not revolutionary. Cogent, compelling critiques of capitalism have been around since Marx. Maybe his book goes further, but in the interview I didn't hear much motivation to delve into his book. It seemed like Mr. Rotering was a garden-variety idealist. A dreamer who just assumes everything will turn out nice if only his ideas are implemented. Rotering says a, quote, key insight is that people with more free time will find better ways to express themselves, especially sexually, and this will relieve the stresses we feel. This is not a new idea at all. Hippies have been saying that since the 60s, French libertines since the 19th century. Our zeal for growth must be, quote, sublimated. Future generations will be taken into account. Job loss will not be permitted. It's all these passive verbs. Who does this permitting? Those are the leaders he is aching for, obviously, but more importantly, how does a good leader actively enforce this? Sanctioned wants, he says, are approved by society. How is this approval measured and enforced, assuming we are to remain a free country? Or are you proposing totalitarianism? He didn't really have any answer to Justin about how can we sell people on a contracted, sustainable lifestyle in the face of all the advertising for the opposite. Now, I understand where Mr. Rotering is coming from. Of course, most people around us seem like they're sleepwalking through the motions of zombie capitalism for no reason, and it looks like they just need a wake-up call. I have come over many years to believe this is not the case. I think most people have seen the problems at some level, even subconsciously. But mostly when I look at America, I am reminded of the old Hindu adage, that it is possible to wake up someone who is sleeping, but it is not possible to wake up someone who is pretending to be asleep. As environmental and economic collapse forces scarcity upon us, people are going to cling much harder to their perceived advantages, not less, as he supposes. I think this is already happening, just like the environmental collapse is already happening. Mr. Rotering, I'm afraid the notion that everyone will willingly and uniformly make the quote-unquote right choices when simply presented with the facts, that particular idea is a relic, which died with the 20th century. Events since then have shown pretty conclusively that people will remain wholeheartedly loyal to a bad idea for at least as long as it gains them a material advantage, or longer if the idea is wrapped up in their self-identity or if they hope that the easy advantage will someday return. He mentions the book Ecotopia by Ernest Kallenbach. I read that book, and I think everyone grappling with this issue should look at it too. But I think very few of your readers will take it seriously as some kind of blueprint or template. It's a fundamentally silly book, and I say that with affection. Read it today, 40 years after it was written, and it's going to look as dated as polyester slacks. And that embarrassment may shed light on some of the things we've learned since then about how social change occurs. A lot of the book talks about former business executives in urban San Francisco giving up their glass towers, going on deer hunts with bows and arrows, and smearing their faces with paint because they have always longed to live closer to nature. Given what we know about people like Lloyd Blankfein and Mark Zuckerberg, do you really see that happening? There's your next satire segment right there, guys. That is the difference between a vision and a strategy. I like the book, but please give the book a read and tell me if anyone thinks it's still useful for a blueprint for social change in the 21st century. Rotering's model supposes that revolutions are implemented by leaders in response to good ideas by intellectuals. Okay, that might possibly be true for political revolutions. For this purpose, I'm defining a political revolution as one that benefits a certain class or segment of society over another one. The American Revolution, perhaps, was the revolution I know of which brought the most benefits to the widest portion of society. Yet still, it was mainly for the benefit of a certain class of people, white male landowners and business owners. The roles of Negro slaves, Native Americans, and women, for example, weren't really changed for another couple of centuries. If we truly need a revolution to get us past this time of ecological and economic crisis, it needs to affect everybody, because literally everybody is contributing to the crisis. And basically everyone in America is reaping the benefits of environmental exploitation. Contrast a political revolution to a societal revolution, like the Industrial Revolution or the Agricultural Revolution. Can anyone name a leader of the Industrial Revolution besides Henry Ford? Can anyone name one leader of the Agricultural Revolution? Alfred Nobel, maybe? I think these cultural revolutions, lifestyle revolutions, are led more by habits, large numbers of average people adopting advantageous habits. I note Mr. Rotering was at a loss when Justin floated the idea that people might not wake up to the dilemma until it's too late to save the ecosystem. He just shrugged and said, "Well, then that's it. What can I say?" Another advantage of the strategy of adopting good habits is those habits can still be useful and preserve and prolong human life even after, gods forfend, after the environment or the economy collapses. For example, people who work close to home and bike or walk there today tend to spend a lot less time and money on their cars. And the habit of living without a car will work just as well after the petroleum is all gone. The way major cities like, say, Long Beach or Portland have increased bike ridership is not by some charismatic leader outlawing cars or petroleum, but by promoting better habits and making biking easier for everyday people. We should think less about leaders and instead dream up more good habits and think about how they get adopted widespread across the nation, how to make small, green, sustainable habits advantageous over current industrial habits. This is, of course, an idea that John Michael Greer has mentioned more than once. We should also consider another of JMG's observations. The assets and advice which are advantageous and smart during an economic upswing reverse themselves and become bad ideas, bad advice, and liabilities when the economy contracts. I didn't hear this from Mr. Rotering at all, but this is a clue towards what kinds of personal habits we will need to adopt as the economy contracts. Cars are yet again a good example, or, also, owning multiple houses, huge McMansions, this used to be a no-brainer. Obviously, that's how people were supposed to get rich. But today, the disadvantages are starting to outweigh the advantages. I am certainly not getting on my high horse. Although I have eschewed some of the bad habits, I too have failed to give up all or even most of my industrialized habits. But much as I'd like to do so, I don't see it happening, regardless of charismatic leaders, and not all in one fell swoop. I'd like to think I'm a moral and idealistic person, but I know very well that I will adopt good habits piecemeal and only where and when there's a tangible advantage to me in adopting a different lifestyle. In my opinion, our job is to invent and create new advantageous habits that can outcompete the bad old ones. That's what we need the idea men for. Mr. Rotering keeps saying he believes the big problem today is a lack of ideas. I disagree. Ideas are cheap and plentiful. There are still public libraries stuffed to the gills with good ideas from history and from today. I know lots of people with tons of good ideas, and I have a few of my own. Fantastic-sounding ideas from industrialists and capitalists are what got us into this mess, because when you implement an idea, you can rarely think out or even predict the unintended consequences of your idea. Good habits, by contrast, are difficult to find and acquire, and they are in very short supply. That's what makes them valuable. I was a lot more in agreement with your second guest in episode 73B. It's always worth hearing someone's perspective when they have traveled and lived inside a flashpoint area, such as Egypt, rather than staying home and proposing theoretical ideas. David Blacker's discussion of eliminationism, about how automation and technology makes more and more people obsolete, particularly the McDonald's jobs he discusses, it strongly reminded me of Marshall Brain's Manus series, a brief sci-fi story about the perspective on the ground during this process, as fewer and fewer people are needed and employed. It's quick, it's extremely relevant when talking about productivity and automation, and it's so much worth a read. It's free as a webpage or available on Kindle and Reddit. Find it at http://marshallbrain.com/mana1.htm. That's mana1.htm. That's it. I'm eager to hear episode 74. Keep up the good work.